From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Are you good at giving gifts?
Your mother hasn't opened my present yet. Beauty, isn't she?
Well, it's hard for me to judge, since I've never bowled in my life.
Well, if you don't want it, I know someone who does.
Americans return around $70 million worth of gifts every year. The Break Room wonders why we're terrible at buying presents. First, though, earlier this week we talked about mixing Southern cocktails.
When you ask bartenders for Southern recipes, the majority of them are going to give you brown liquor-based drinks, especially bourbon and rye.
That's Sarah Camp Milam of the Southern Foodways Alliance. Here are your first thoughts. Hovey Smith in Fayetteville, Georgia, called to tell us about his own drink recipe.
Called a moon melon. And what this consists of is a bonded liquor, Shine On Georgia Moon, and Georgia watermelon. And what you do is you take the watermelon and slice it, and you put it in the alcohol, and you put that in the freezer. And then when it comes out, you serve it as a cold, refreshing, alcoholic drink with watermelon on a very hot Georgia day.
Look, we love getting your drink recipes, so you can send more of those. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. The list of nicknames and titles for filmmaker John Waters is a long and legendary one. We won't read all of them, but Waters has proudly earned many of them, and he's responsible for cult hits like Pink Flamingos, Multiple Maniacs, and Polyester. Here's a clip of Johnny Depp in the film Crybaby.
I've never given a French kiss before.
Watch, it's easy. You just open your mouth, and I open mine. We wiggle our tongues together, and it feels real sexy.
Waters is more than a filmmaker, though. He's a writer, actor, fashion icon, stand-up comedian, art collector. He performs in Atlanta tonight with his one-man show, A John Waters Christmas, and joins me on the line. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Can we talk first about what it is about Christmas in particular? Why Christmas is a good John Waters season?
Well, because it's such an extreme time. You know, you can't avoid it. It's like a tsunami wave coming at you. And I understand how people sometimes are offended when you say Merry Christmas to them. Maybe they don't believe in the virgin birth, you know. So I like Christmas. I had a great Christmas when I was young. They had Santa come to our community, and I recognized it was the man that lived up the street. I think they should have gotten somebody from another neighborhood. But I was kind of excited that I knew about the lie.
Whereas other people didn't? I mean, did you tell people?
I didn't go ruin it for people, no. I said to my parents, well, isn't that Mr. So-and-so? And they would go, well, he just works for Santa or something. You know, they made some lame excuse up. So it is really one of the first lies that parents tell their children. So you can't really complain when later in life they tell them drugs are bad and they don't pay any attention to them.
So your mother, your biographer says that your mother thought it was the puppets in the film Lily that had the biggest influence on your career to come.
That's probably true. I don't think I've ever met a film director that didn't have puppets when they were young.
Really?
But yes, no, they all had them. And later in life, all your actors say to you, we're not your puppets, you know. They are. And I had a career as a puppeteer. I went on the Howdy Doody show. It was Lily, definitely, probably in the beginning, but Howdy Doody had maybe more to do about it because my uncle was connected in New York and got me to be on the Howdy Doody show in the Peanut Gallery, which at the time, that show was watched more than anything anybody watches on television today. And I remember seeing it and realizing it was another fake and a lie that I was drawn to show business because it was all a lie, really, and I liked being on the inside and knowing it. Same with Santa.
Yeah, and not telling them.
No, I didn't ever tell. And the only one I hated was the Easter Bunny because, to me, no one believes in that. When you see that, it's a new way to humiliate women. A man never plays the Easter Bunny in a mall, but they always have some poor woman in there. And there's even websites where they talk about that they can't even see the child and it's so hot in there often that they vomit inside the head of the Easter Bunny when they're talking to the children.
Let's take a clip from the movie you're probably best known for, and that's Hairspray. This is from the 1988 version, which you wrote and directed.
Hey, girl, what you doing over there?
Can't you see? I'm spraying my hair. when a project is going to sort of hit?
Well, when I wrote Hairspray, the original movie, I never thought I had written anything more commercial or anything. When we got a PG rating, I thought my career was over. But when I did hear the musical for the first time, when Margot Lyon, the producer, took me in and just played some of the music, and I saw, then saw the first table read, everybody thought this could be a giant hit, but no one was. Everyone was afraid to say that out loud and jinx it. And people would say to us, really Broadway people, that is Vice really counted, the only thing you can do is screw this up. And so it was so together so early in what happens with a musical that I found out later that it spooked people, because nobody, they didn't want to say it's done, and they kept trying different things and everything, even though what was originally done was the right version.
So how do you make a quality movie with on so little money?
Well, you know, I don't think it's ever money. I think actually people have too much money now. $100 million movies that are all special effects. To me, they're science projects. They're not movies. I think bad special effects are more interesting, if you ask me. They're more engaging. So to me, I don't think money has to do with it. It's your idea. It's the writing. It's the characters. It's the people that are in it. Every kid makes their first movie now on a cell phone. I made it with a 8mm camera. It's the same thing. You make them with your friends. My friends were maybe a little more extreme, but my friends weren't really like those characters. People believe they were because the films were so poorly shot, they thought they were documentary snuff movies or something.
I want to play this comment from playwright Tennessee Williams, which I understand he's one of your role models. In this one, it's an interview in which he's talking about the admiration he had for the poet Hart Crane.
We both wrote out of an intense personal need.
Was he also homosexual?
Yes, he was indeed. And he made absolutely no disguise of the fact. But I don't think he gave a damn whether he shocked people. And I never cared whether I shocked people, because I think people who are shocked by the truth are not deserving of the truth.
That comment reminds me of you.
Well, Tennessee Williams was certainly brave. He was one of the first ones that ever just admitted he was gay. But what he said is what I believe in. Basically, he said gay is not enough. What Tennessee Williams wanted was bohemia, and that's what I wanted too. And bohemia is a mix of straight, gay, black, white, every race. So everybody knows what the other people that don't fit in are thinking. So it's still, I think we have too many gay people now. I joke in my Christmas show, I want people to come in and have to audition to be gay. We have enough. Please go back in the closet.
Not to take this to a more dark place, but...
That's not dark.
I'm about to take it to on a dark
turn,
right. Sadly. Because, you know, that's almost, to me, the message of Hairspray, is this embracing of diversity and different cultures. And we've gone the other way since you wrote Hairspray.
Well, I haven't. The government has. I don't think I have.
Well, but Americans in general have become more...
No, 33% of Americans this week have gone the other way.
You don't think Americans have become more tribal?
We got to make the other side laugh. If you want to change somebody's mind, you get them to laugh. So, and it's going to be tough at Christmas when everybody goes home because of politics this year. There's going to be a lot of trees knocked over. So I'm telling everybody to bring a political abuse whistle, and every time somebody starts talking about politics, just blow it, and people start laughing, and then they won't get on each other's nerves or knock over the tree in a fistfight.
Then let's talk about you as a not just a cultural icon, but a gay icon. This is a little clip of your appearance on The Simpsons, and this episode you play a gay store owner, and your character's sexuality makes Homer extremely uncomfortable, and you ask him about that.
Homer, what have you got against gays?
You know, it's not usual. If there was a law, it would be against it.
Oh, Homer, please, you're embarrassing yourself.
No, I'm not, Marge. They're embarrassing me. They're embarrassing America. They turned the Navy into a floating joke. They ruined all our best names like Bruce and Lance and Julian. Those were the toughest names we had. Now they're just... You
queer?
Did you ever regret becoming sort of the spokes for a while, one of the spokespersons for the homosexual community?
Well, to me, no one ever had the nerve to ask me. I was on the cover of The Advocate, the gay paper, and it said America's Most Out Director. They never asked me if I was gay. How dare you presume, you know? So it always used to make me laugh. People would say that, but they would be too afraid. It was like my parents. They thought the answer might be worse than gay. And once my father said, "Do you have to say you're gay in USA Today?" That was a paper that his friends read. So I respected that wish. I said it everywhere but USA Today. Seemed fair. He paid for Pink Flamingos, and I paid him back. So
wait,
that seemed like a fair trade, and he was horrified. Yeah.
Yeah, he'd seen Pink Flamingos.
No, he never saw it. To the day he died, he never saw it.
Did your mom?
Yeah, I think neither ever saw Pink Flamingos. They knew about it. You know, they couldn't really ever get away with it. But I don't know that I always say gaily incorrect things, too. So I always am for the minorities that can't even get along with their own minority. Those are my people. That's who'll be there tonight.
So, and it's interesting to me that you have maintained this relationship with so many of your Dreamlanders, I think you call them, so many of your talent, your actors, even crew and friends over a decades-long career, while we see that a very opposite thing happening very often.
Well, I judge people by if they have old friends. If you don't have any old friends, you must be a jerk, because old friends are what get you through life, and they're the people that count, not the people you meet in your job, not the people that tell you you're good, not your fans, but real old friends, and I do have them. I do, and I'm proud to say that.
So let's go back to what I really wanted to talk about, which was late people. Because
with what people?
Late people. Because
late
you were
people.
Exactly on time, which is quite rare among celebrities. And I respect that.
I hate people that are late. It's rude. And it's also like I am very scheduled today. As soon as I hang up, I go into another meeting. So basically, my time is very well planned. So, yeah, I just don't wait. If I'm someone in the restaurant, I'll just get up and leave if you don't live there. I'm not waiting 5 minutes.
All right. So the reason you're coming to Atlanta is for the John Waters Christmas. Can you tell the audience what to expect?
Well, it's how to get through it. Really, I talk about everything. Criminals, I talk about Christmas presents, about gift cards, fruit baskets, the worst thing. How can somebody dare give me a pear for Christmas? And gift cards, that just means you think the person's stupid, that you know they don't have any interest, so I can't think. I had to use a gift card once at Starbucks. It was so humiliating. Really. Oh, here, I have this. I can get some free coffee. It was just embarrassing to have to fill out more paperwork than getting food stamps.
It's hard for me even to imagine John Waters going to order a coffee at Starbucks.
Well, I'm in airports, you know.
Oh,
that's
right.
All they have,
of
right?
Of course, yeah.
So I think I talk about everything. I warn you that one thing, I have a criminal friend that told me that he used to go every Christmas Eve to graveyards and hide out. When people got out of the car to leave flowers, he'd steal their pocketbooks.
Oh, man.
So, well, criminals have to buy presents, too, at Christmas. So I'm just warn people of some of the things that can happen at Christmas.
It's almost a public service announcement.
That's, it is, yes.
That is filmmaker John Waters. He's in Atlanta tonight for his one-man show, A John Waters Christmas. Starts at 8 o'clock at the Variety Playhouse. You can get details at gpbnews.org. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Just ahead, the Break Room gang weighs in on Alabama's U.S. Senate election and whether it's time to go back to the moon. First, though, the story of a Georgia minstrel performer who influenced a lot of today's music. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Earlier this week, we asked what you learned about the Civil War in school. I was told by American history professor at Macon State College that the Civil War was not fought because of slavery, but on the basis of the South's right to secede from the Union. That took 5 years to correct in my mind. Holly Taggart replied, "People often say it was due to economics, but of course the economic system was based on slavery. I admit I was more comfortable with the economics argument, but then I got a little more thoughtful." And Ramblin' Peck tweeted, "Any day is a good day to share out the various articles of secession. Blunt, clear, primary sources ignored in every classroom in the South because they don't fit the state's rights narrative." You can join this discussion. It's at OST Talk on Twitter, or just give us a call, 404-500-9457. Macon is justifiably proud of its music history. Little Richard, Otis Redding, the Allman Brothers Band. Dig a little further back, though, and you'll find another Macon musician, one who might just be as influential as those names you just heard. GPB's Grant Blankenship examines the life and music of Emmett Miller.
Odds are good you've never heard of Emmett Miller. Not too long ago, neither had Ben Arthur.
I'd literally never heard of Emmett Miller before.
Arthur produces a PBS show called Songcraft Presents. He and another songwriter explore some piece of music history, then they write a song about it. For a show in Macon, he's teaming with Americana musician and scholar Dom Flemons, founding member of the Grammy-winning Carolina Chocolate Drops. So Arthur asked Flemons, what's interesting in Macon?
And he said, have you ever heard of Emmett Miller? And I had to admit that, no.
So who was Emmett Miller?
I got a feeling called a blues since my mama said goodbye.
This is Emmett Miller in his 1927 recording of Lovesick Blues. Many fans of country music may recognize the song as a Hank Williams tune, which it was.
I got a feeling called the blues, oh Lord, since my...
About 20 years after Emmett Miller's recording. That thing Miller does where his voice breaks, you hear it all over pop music. Here's Ray Charles.
She give me money.
And Bono. Today, that break, it signals sincerity, emotional depth, soul. As far as anyone can tell, Emmett Miller just thought it was a good trick. Miller dreamt of hitting the road like the showman he saw at Macon's Grand Opera House, where he first performed at 12. Which is why Arthur and Flemons picked one of the Grand's glittering box seats to start writing their song together. Flemons came with a riff in hand.
Think back on those good old days.
He says he wants a song you'll be stuck singing all day, but there's a challenge.
Because all this stuff has been happening recently in the past several months that I feel like...
And when you say all this stuff?
Oh, well, like the...
Charlottesville?
Yeah, Charlottesville, and I mean, even the mass shootings and things.
So
like
why
that
does Charlottesville live side by side with Emmett Miller in Dom Flemons' mind?
I'm a man, was in bad shape.
What's the matter, boy?
Didn't sleep any last night.
Why?
That's Miller in a 1951 film called Yes, Sir, Mr. Bones. Young Emmett Miller's heroes, they were blackface minstrels. And he was one, too. Without question, this is out of bounds today. But Ben Arthur says there's that voice. Dom Flemons fills in the backstory for the music.
It was always for nostalgia. At first, it was trying to depict plantation Negroes.
White performers first started appearing in blackface in 1840s New York. From the start, it was about white Northerners' fantasies of the South. Stephen Foster.
Way down upon the Swanee River.
He wrote for the minstrel shows. Never laid eyes on Florida. Even early on, there were critics. Frederick Douglass in 1848 described minstrels as, quote, the filthy scum of white society, who've stolen from us a complexion denied to them by nature. He was no more fond of African-American performers who wore blackface. But Dom Flemons says minstrel music holds an important distinction.
It was the first popular music that was uniquely called American music.
It would later give birth to both jazz and country music. Still, it looks like it was minstrelsy Emmett Miller loved. He stuck with it after some of his contemporaries, like Jimmy Rogers, had traded blackface for cowboy hats. A few of Miller's old buddies even later landed on the Grand Ole Opry. Ben Arthur.
Tom Waits is not a homeless hobo. Costuming and pretending to be something we're not, something that we find fascinating, is here to this day.
Miller never traded costumes, and that's at the heart of Arthur and Flemons' song.
Your lips were red and your eyes was wild. You think old Jack Johnson taught you how to smile, but when the mask is broken, shards on the floor. You gotta wonder what you're still fighting for in those good old days.
Miller died, largely forgotten, in 1962, about a decade after his last shot at a comeback that never came. He's buried in a neglected cemetery in Macon. The Emmett Miller episode of Ben Arthur's PBS show Songcraft Presents will be ready for air in January. For GPB News, I'm Grant Blankenship.
Wanna talk about them good old days? You wanna talk about them good old days?
It has been a long week. We've talked about head transplants, spun some good Southern music, studied what makes a really, truly great Southern cocktail. So it's Friday, and that means we have gathered a group of smart people together. We're going to kick back, unwind, think about what the heck happened this week. It's time for the break room.
You know, this could be a lot more, it might not be just such a simple, you know?
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Jerry, just remember, it's not a lie if you believe it.
We've got no food, we've got no jobs, our pets' heads are falling off!
Okay, just calm down.
In the break room this week, Ed Sohn is Vice President of Product at Thomson Reuters Legal, Samaya Khalifa, Executive Director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, Eric Siegel is Constitutional Law Professor at Georgia State University, and Fayette County Commissioner is with us as well, Steve Brown. Welcome to Friday, everyone.
Hey, great Friday. Yay. Good morning.
And as Eric pointed out, happy birthday to the Bill of Rights, born Absolutely. This day in 1791.
The original meaning of it is still what it is today. No, sorry.
All right. It has been 48 years since the U.S. originally won the race to space. That's when we went to the moon. President Trump wants to go again, not just to the moon, Mars as well. But this would be the 11th trip to the moon for the United States. Is it worth the expense?
With one condition. President Trump goes with it.
Oh, come on.
Well, you know, I'm wondering why we're still looking at bringing people to these planets. We have incredible robotics technology, artificial intelligence. We really don't need to land people on Mars unless it's just for show. There's really no reason to do it. You can gather anything you want off of those planets using robotics. Why are we still sending people to planets? What's the point?
That's my question about the moon, too. What have we not? What else does the 11th trip get
I'm wondering what else is there that we haven't already done on the moon that we're going to risk people's lives and spend a fortune doing?
I think that there's every president sees value in trying to send a person to the moon because of what an incredible achievement it was for the country at the time, a victory over sort of competing countries and, you know, exploring the final frontier. I think trying to recapture that, you know, politically is not a bad move. I think that it could be inspirational to the next generation of astronauts and people who want to explore space. But at the end of the day, I thought we all decided we're going to stop doing this. Didn't we all say that NASA is that sent its final manned space mission up there? We're going to privatize
Texas.
It. We're going to let Elon Musk do it.
Well, I think the president needs to concentrate on the people right here in the country. How about health care? How about, you know, the tax reform that's going to cost us more money? If he's got extra money in his budget, let's put it locally here versus taking it up to the moon or Mars.
That's a good point. Since we're speaking already, and by the way, a two-person mission to the moon is somewhere around between $1.5 and $2 billion. So let's talk about something closer, Alabama. We got some...
Another foreign land.
Come on now. We got the results of Alabama's special election.
For the first time in a quarter of a century, Alabama is sending a Democrat to Washington, and the Republican majority in the Senate will now be razor thin, 51 to 49.
So, was Democrat Doug Jones' win a referendum on the president? The person who said that the most was probably Steve Bannon. So, do we believe that, or do we think that this was more about the specific candidate, Roy Moore, against whom he was running?
I will defer, but I want to say one thing really quick. It's not over. Don't think this is over. The Secretary of State has not certified it. Moore has not conceded. And I know the world is treating this as over, but on Twitter I have been making this point and many people are agreeing. I'm just saying, it's not over.
But also,
happy holidays, everyone.
but I think it also gives us a fresh look in terms of people have the power to go and vote. It has been like, hey, it's a one-party rule, and the voices of everyone are not heard. But now we say, hey, look at the polls and what happened. I agree with you. It's not over until it's over, and hopefully that will happen very soon.
Well, you know, and I think Alabama is still a solid red state. To deliberate on that, I think, is meaningless. But, you know, I thought the interesting thing about this election was, and to get Jones just inching above the finish line there, it was an odd couple. It was Senator Richard Shelby and NBA star Charles Barkley, who were the loudest at the last minute. And I think Barkley was really responsible to a large degree for turning out the African-American population, which came out in huge numbers. Because otherwise, why? What have they got in that race? I don't know.
Well, but, and it wasn't just Charles Barkley. I think a lot of Black Thought leaders were getting on the radio and in media outlets to drive the Black turnout. Which, by the way, is actually the story, I think, of this election, is the incredible voter turnout from the Black community, hashtag Black Votes Matter. I think that the other, to go to whether it's a referendum on the president, I think that the members of Congress who have been trying to align themselves with the president because it was politically expedient are now having second thoughts because a candidate endorsed by this president
has lost. The third candidate
lost.
Endorsed.
And obviously, Roy Moore is a very special case, had a weird background, et cetera. But this is the person that President Trump endorsed. By the way, it wasn't the person he endorsed in the primary. He actually endorsed with a strange
weird background. Yeah. That's how you
well, obviously extenuating circumstances. But nevertheless, that's I think going to change even present calculus about the tax reform bill, about how Congress people are aligning themselves with the president.
Charles Barkley, by the way, has said in the past he might run for governor someday.
Yes, that will
good
be
man.
Interesting.
I vote for him.
All right.
I'll move and vote for
all
him.
All right, so listen, it is the holiday season. However you celebrate, most of us buy gifts at some point, and that's not always easy.
Your mother hasn't opened my present yet. Beauty, isn't she?
Well, it's hard for me to judge, since I've never bowled in my life.
Well, if you don't want it, I know someone who does.
Displeased recipients return about $70 million worth of gifts every year. Nobody knows then how much that would go because there's a lot of people who don't return them, right? Hate right. them, but don't return them. So why are we so wrong about this? Why are we so bad at buying presents?
I have a hard time buying stuff for myself. I buy it. I sit there and think about it for a couple of weeks and then decide whether I keep it or not. I had a funny story. One time I gave a friend a beautiful platter, crystal platter. A year and a half later, she gave it back to me as a gift and she forgot that I gave it to her.
Well, Celeste, I think everybody needs to read your book and it's about communication. And you know, we feel obligated to buy somebody something, but then we have no communication with these people, so
we don't
really
listen.
Know what to get them.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we don't... But my idea, though, is like you do registries for children and your weddings. I'm going to have a birthday and Christmas registry on Amazon.com.
Brilliant.
And
a wish list.
Everybody will know.
My
just
wife's
go
family,
look me up.
And I'm opposed to this, excuse me, my wife's family literally spells out all the gifts they want, from what stores, in what size, and variety, which I think is the other extreme.
Mm. Yeah.
And I am, and my family officially opposed to this, but that's what they do.
Well, I feel like we should just get everyone's last book, it sounds like.
Yeah.
I think for the whole
seconded.
Ride.
Seconded. Right.
But, you know, like, also, it is a little bit of commentary on the society that we live in, the relationships that we have, and whether or not there is an art to gift giving about knowing and thinking about what defines a person, the gift that's appropriate to that. And I think in the era of consumerism, where everyone who wants anything can get it on Amazon Prime anytime, and in the era of disassociated relationships and sort of relationships over social media, it is much harder to buy a gift for someone and to engage
Celeste,
in that craft.
If you were wondering, I wouldn't mind my own show for Christmas.
That's not within my purview to gift. But I mean, we have a couple minutes here. Is there a safe thing? I mean, except for money, which I think is a terrible idea.
Gift cards.
But gift card, you just heard John Waters say that gift card means you think the other person's dumb. That's his opinion. But what about food? Is like food a safe?
I love food.
Right?
Yeah, you could do food. And, you know, there are these traditional things with ties and things like that that guys
ties?
I'm just saying, you know, that people always buy routinely. I can't tell you how many times I've gotten ties for gifts.
I want to point out that you're not wearing a tie. In fact,
that's
nobody
right.
is.
No one
nobody
is wearing
is.
A tie. And I'm looking against the control room. Certainly my producers are not wearing ties.
All joking aside, actually, books have been what's been on my mind.
Right?
I really think that getting someone a book, a hardcover book, it's a little bit of a vintage gift. It's not an ebook on Kindle or an audiobook. And saying, like, I think that this is something that has really influenced me, and I want you to share in that so we can talk about it.
I think that's great. Yeah, and it's not just my book. I buy people books all the time.
Now,
books that
only
I love.
5% of people will actually read the book, so then it might not turn into this wonderful conversation.
It's a little utopian, of you. But,
yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, technology is a tough gift, too, and everybody wants to get into more technology, but it's so hard to buy technology for people. And, you know, are you Mac? Are you app? Macintosh? Are you Android?
And how long will it be
or, you know, whatever. You know,
massages usually go over well.
Yeah.
That's actually...
I'd like to go to the moon, actually, make that happen.
With my $1.5
billion. Sure.
Well, let's put this out to the listeners. What's a good, reliable gift? Is there a fail-safe when it comes to gift buying? Because clearly Americans stink at it. It is Friday. We're hanging out in the break room. You know how to reach us, 404-500-9457, or find us on Twitter and Facebook. Just ahead, we're going to talk about what ain't good grammar, actually, what is not good conversation. Also, some tall tales and a little sprinkling of feminism for your Friday. That's next. It's on Second Thought. It ain't easy. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. We're having a coffee and a little chat in the break room. It's Friday, of course. My guests today are Fayette County Commissioner Steve Brown, Eric Siegel, Professor of Law at Georgia State University, Ed Sohn, Vice President of Product at Thomson Reuters Legal, and Sumaya Khalifa is with the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta. Okay, I don't know how you feel when you get to the end of the week and you just kind of collapse and all you can do is sit on the couch and watch Netflix. Americans are overworked. We don't use our vacation time. We don't use our sick time. And at this point, a lot of people standard work more than a 40-hour week. But it is turns out that a 40-hour work week is probably overdoing it.
I can't believe we drove around all day and there's not a single job in this town. There is nothing, nada, zip.
Yeah, unless you want to work 40 hours a week.
Okay, if you work too much, you are not alone. But it turns out for a long time we've thought overwork decreases the quality of what you're doing, right? You're getting tired, and so you're not doing as well. But it turns out it also undermines your creativity and your innovation, and it undermines your cognition, and it can make you physically ill. So why don't we take some time off?
I'm too tired to think about that.
Well, you know, sleep is so essential. And if you're in a stressful job, and I think a lot of it is stress. If you're working long hours and you're in a stressful job, yeah, it wrecks your life. It makes you ill. It ruins your sleep. You don't have that cognitive ability because you're not getting your sleep. But if you're passionate about something, you watch somebody who's creative, they love their job, they're working long hours, they don't have the same problems, I've noticed. And when I'm working on a project that I'm passionate about, sleep is really not my issue. But when it's stress-related, that's when it really starts to bug me the worst.
I think overworking gives a perception that you're working very hard and that you are winning at the competition of working very hard, which in a kind of capitalistic free market economy is rewarded.
Makes you more valuable.
It makes you more valuable. It makes you differentiate among your peers in the office. It makes you as a business differentiate from a competing business. And so I think that there's something kind of fundamental about this idea of competition that really drives us to constantly be concerned about the perception of being of working hard as opposed to finding that right balanced ability to deliver work product. I think there's also sort of some personal tendencies like prioritizing the urgent over the important, things like that. But I think that, you know, as a society, we'll need to start deferring credit and letting other people work when we could be instead of constantly be competing with one another.
Overworking equals success in a lot of people's minds. And
in their minds, but that may be a delusion.
It is a delusion, and we need to stop and think, is it really worth it? And I have to tell you, I'm taking 2 weeks off starting tomorrow. Yay.
Nowhere is this more prevalent than for lawyers, I think.
Yeah.
And I have to say also that
it
does...
I feel like journalists could give you guys a run for your money.
And architects too, but and doctors. Okay, everybody. But I'm not sure Americans... I'm not sure Americans work harder than most... You started off by saying Americans. I don't know if we work harder than most other countries, but one last thought on this. I think, sadly, tragically, for some people, this is a serious statement. It's an escape from home and family. Mm-hmm. And that's... If you have a happy family life, you're going to work less most of the time.
Hmm. Let's have our listeners weigh in on this. Why do you work more than 40 hours? You know how to reach us. Find us on social media. And let's move on. The white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups that staged the first marches in Charlottesville, Virginia that turned tragic. now want to stage another march there to mark the one-year anniversary of their original march. The city denied the permit, and a permit is required. So what do we think about this? The city said, no, you may not march here on that date. Is this a violation of these groups' First Amendment rights? Should they let the march go forward?
So the applicable law here would be, is this a reasonable time, place, and manner restriction? Because the city cannot say, we don't like you, so you can't march. That would be unconstitutional. I think the city is within its rights to say too soon at this moment in time. At some point, this group is going to be is going to have to march again. The really big issue, as the ACLU has pointed out many times, no guns. The city should say, you can march, but no guns. They will sue. That will be a big lawsuit.
Yeah, I think ultimately public safety has to be the prevailing interest. And, you know, there is a permitting process for a purpose, and it's reasonable time and place. And I think that that's, if there is that kind of rationale behind it, behind the denying of a permit, then that must be justified. I'm not inside the permit granting office at Charlottesville, so I'm not exactly sure what their logic is. But I do think that the public safety is absolutely an interest that you have to balance against freedom of assembly and expression.
But you know, I can tell you from a governmental perspective, when I watched the video of the last protest and everything that was going on, Charlottesville, and although they're not a major metropolitan area, but they did a really poor job of handling the Antifa groups and the white supremacist groups and everybody else who showed up. They let them merge together. There was no separation of the parties. I mean, it was a strategic nightmare. And I think they really need to up their game if they're going to allow this again. But I think they should share part of the blame for what happened.
I totally agree. Plus, emotions are still way too raw right now to have another march.
But whenever it is, there should be a no-gun rule.
Absolutely.
And that case could go to the Supreme Court.
Absolutely.
All right. Lynn, let's move on to something a little bit less depressing. Well, I know, I guess it depends on how you define depressing. According to some people, slang is ruining our communication skills.
I am not Mr. Lebowski. You're Mr. Lebowski. I'm the dude. So that's what you call me, you know? That or his dudeness or duder or, you know, El Duderino, if you're not into the whole brevity thing.
All right. We have new research out that shows native English speakers are the worst communicators on the planet. And we're not talking about bad grammar. We're talking about the fact that people don't understand what it is that we're saying to them. Turns out we talk too fast. We use jokes and slang and references that other people don't get. We send emails with mystery abbreviations in them. The researcher said the native English speaker is the only one who might not feel the need to accommodate or adapt to others. Why are we so bad at actually, I mean, we talk a lot.
I hear that every single day as an intercultural consultant. When I work with executives from outside the United States, I hear those complaints all the time. Speak too fast, using jokes, using baseball English. Even people from England, when they talk and communicate with U.S. Americans, they have a hard time understanding what we're saying. So it is a real issue in the business world.
Well, to quote Judah Friedlander, I'd say it's because we took English and we perfected it. Obviously, that's not the truth.
That's clearly a joke.
So, yeah. So, I mean,
using another one of those jokes that nobody gets.
That nobody gets, exactly. I thought I would just have a mysterious pop culture reference that no one will get. The you know, one thing that I remember hearing very clearly is for my friends who teach English as a second language, is that English is actually the hardest second language. And therefore, is it possible that English is just the hardest language? And as a result, like, it requires a certain amount of skill and proficiency that's not present in our society anymore, and we have to resort to speaking in lazy metaphor all the time. I mean, that there's a real possibility that our ability to speak our own native language has degraded.
I think part of it goes back to America's John Wayne, Ronald Reagan, head west mentality and our focus on the individual, not the group. If you focus on the group, your desire is to communicate with others. If your focus is on yourself, that desire is minimized. And this transcends this issue and goes to what America, either for good or better or for worse, is all about.
I mean, speaking as a communication expert, it's odd to me that we would bother talking if we not don't care if people understand what we're saying, right? Like,
if you're
why?
A narcissist, it's very not you. I mean, if the person well, is a narcissist,
but why bother?
But too, Celeste, when you're talking about people in other nations, we don't really have a great appreciation for the cultures of other nations. So, like, for example, I do a lot with Japanese executives and things of this nature, and they're shaking their head yes, like they're understanding you. They don't have a clue what you're saying, but they don't want to lose face, and so they act like they're agreeing with you and they're picking this up. And we need to understand those differences and make sure that we reiterate. Do you understand? You know,
John
is this
Wayne
clear?
Didn't care about that.
Well, all right. That's the problem.
If you're just joining us, we are hanging out in the break room. You just heard the voice of Fayette County Commissioner Steve Brown. Also with us is Eric Siegel of Georgia State, Sumaya Khalifa of the Islamic Speakers Bureau, and Ed Sohn of Thomson Reuters Legal. And if you want to weigh in on any of these, you're welcome to join the break room with us. Find us on social media. We're at OST Talk on Twitter. All right, let's talk about lying. Some awards aren't necessarily compliments. We know that, right, from the Razzies. PolitiFact has announced its lie of the year for 2017, and they say the biggest lie this year is that Russian election interference is a made-up story. What do we think? Do we agree this is the lie of the year? Does it seem like the biggest one?
The lie of the year, because it was said under under oath, that makes a big difference, is... Justice Gorsuch saying to the Senate Judiciary Committee, I am an originalist. No, he's not. He never has been. He never will be.
Hear, hear.
But this is a lie that's being repeated still. I mean, does it matter if...
This was a year for whoppers. I mean, you know, you could...
That is
just full of stuff. I mean, the whole Fusion GPS thing that's come out, you know, ends up... just circulating a lot of things, the Harvey Weinstein situation and all of his ilk and all these things that are coming out, you know, people saying one thing and doing another. You know, Michael Flynn not relaying everything that he should have to the FBI, which wasn't illegal that he
Sessions.
Said. Yeah, but I mean, you know, the interesting thing about the Flynn...
Jared Kushner's had to revise his...
Well, but the interesting thing about this is, too, it's not... illegal activity for them to say that they spoke to someone. You know, the fact that they were withholding it, and it really had no consequences in terms of legality. And you correct me, Eric, you're the attorney, and Ed, but I mean, I don't know why they would withhold all that.
Yes,
you know,
you do. Yes, you do.
Just well,
because there's so much, more behind it. That's why.
But you know, the government's going to find it out.
Let's go back to this lie of the Russian election interference is fake news. I mean, PolitiFact is basically saying when they choose a lie of the year, often they're saying this is the most impactful one. This is the one that actually has the most consequences.
I think that it has the most far-reaching kind of consequences of a second-order nature, because what does that mean for the, you know, the risk that's in our democracy to outside forces? What does that mean for, you know, forces that desire to collude? What does that mean for, you know, Trump and this particular campaign's getting a lot of attention, but how often has this happened in the past that we haven't even investigated or looked into it? You know, I think that I do still want to respond to the question of, like, what is the biggest lie? And I think emotionally, the American public, I would say the lies were the lies of the 2016 campaign. I think it's just that President Trump would, or the candidate Trump would be presidential, worthy of the office, absolutely trying to drain the swamp and root out corruption. When, you know, just from an intangible and as objective as I can be, you know, from that viewpoint, he's been the opposite of all of those things. And I think that that's, you know, to me, the ongoing lie of the year. The Russian investigation is something that's still being exposed, you know, but I think that this is one where it's already been exposed.
All right. So since we're speaking of POTUS, the number of sexual misconduct allegations against Donald Trump have climbed into the 20s at this point. Here's Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee with her commentary on those claims.
The president has addressed these accusations directly and denied all of these allegations. And this took place long before he was elected to be president. And we feel like these allegations have been answered through that.
Okay, but there's a larger question here, right, for the executive office. And this takes us back even to Bill Clinton. Should a president, because they have more important things to do, or because they're the most powerful person in the country, should a president be shielded from allegations of this kind while they're in office?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. A wrong is a wrong, and it does not matter if others have done it historically, but we need to have a certain moral standard and a certain moral requirement of our chief executive, if you will, for the whole country. If he or she does not hold that up, then how about the rest of the country?
That would be, I agree 100%. The problem is that standard was not applied to Bill Clinton. And that is haunting us until today. The other thing I want to say is Sarah Saunders said, the president denies these things, and these things happened before he was president.
Well, and I, yeah, these things that didn't happen happened before he was president.
Well, back to our English language.
You know, the one thing I would say, though, is to counterpoint to Bill Clinton, certainly he was shielded a lot. And certainly that happened because of influence that was wielded and a certain amount of defense that was applied. And he wasn't ultimately, you know, forced to resign or anything. I would also say that Bill Clinton was not impervious to impeachment proceedings, to investigations, to having his presidency and the productivity of his presidency derailed. And I think that at minimum, I agree, we're kind of haunted by the specter of that. But we have not yet met that level of scrutiny on President Trump himself. So
yeah,
absolutely.
There's no dress,
but we don't
have a dress.
Sure, exactly.
But our culture is different. I mean, with the Me Too campaign, et cetera, our requirements as a nation, as people, you know, the train has left the station. And we cannot say, because he is president, we did not do anything with Bill Clinton, then we're not going to do anything with him. It's a new day.
That's fair. That's
it's
well,
a new day.
And, you know, I think we have a more systemic problem in that we have a lot of people, a lot of factions that hide their abusers and shield their abusers on both sides. This is a bipartisan thing.
Yeah, it's not partisan.
Yeah, I mean, it has to do with politics. It has to do with your employment. I mean, it has to do with a lot of things. And I think maybe what we're seeing today with a lot of people coming out in the Me Too thing, is that an anomaly or is this going to correct things? I don't know. But you've got to stop shielding people and you have to call out your own when these things are going on.
One of the most famous judges in the United States, not on the Supreme Court, Judge Kaczynski of the Ninth Circuit, I have known about his misbehavior for 25 years.
Everyone has.
But I have to say, I plead guilty. It didn't stop me 3 years ago from inviting him to speak at my law school. Should have. Didn't. And that goes to your point and your point. We have to change how we deal with this completely, especially men.
But, you know, and to me, I would just differentiate that as a slightly different problem just because Judge Kaczynski is a thought leader and super brilliant and all these things and is obviously deeply flawed in his character and has had a long, kind of the worst kept secret of the judiciary. This is a question of whether or not the office by itself imparts special protection.
Right.
And I absolutely don't think so. I mean, the president is, you know, published in papers and historical kind of viewpoints, is the first citizen in the United States. You know, and
although his office has said, much like Nixon, that if he did it, he wasn't illegal.
Right? How did that work out for Nixon, though? Everyone keeps fighting Nixon. It's like, well, Nixon, that wasn't illegal. Yeah, he resigned. Like, there's consequence.
After a long time. Well, sure. We have this tweet from Rabbit who says, two words, conduct unbecoming. It's impeachable. They just don't. Conduct unbecoming relates to the military, though, Rabbit, and the president's not a member of the military. We've got like 30 seconds. Steve,
well I was just going to say the hypocrisy is so laden in D.C. that, you know, you've got Congress who's paying hundreds of millions of dollars to pay off women to keep from raising sexual allegations. And they're supposed to be policing the president, you know, in the impeachment procedure.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a farce.
It is. And that's our money that's being paid for the settlements, by the way. We're out of time for the break room. I want to say thank you to Steve Brown of the Fayette County Commission, Eric Siegel of Georgia State, Sumaya Khalifa, Executive Director of the Islamic Speakers Bureau of Atlanta, and Ed Sohn of Thomson Reuters Legal. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. But you know how to reach us. You can get in touch with us on social media or call us on the phone, 404-500-9457. For today and for the week, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.